Voices of VR podcast. Hello, my name is Ken Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So in today's episode, we're going to be diving into the textbook called Human Spatial Computing by Roshanae Gilbert and Doug Northcook that came out on February 5th, 2026. So this is a in-depth textbook starting off with human rights as a foundation and then going back and forth between Roshanae and Doug from each of their different expertise and perspectives as designers for experiential design. You need to have a wide array of all these different things. I think part of the thing like film with XR is that you're going to have lots of specialties that are going in and looking at specific things. But as a broad kind of spatial computing, it's trying to give an overview of all these different fields, but really rooted in human rights and ethics and accessibility and inclusion. And so it's kind of starting off on that and then going into a bit of a history that is looking at the history of human-computer interaction, not through just the lens of technology, but looking at more broadly of this desire to mediate and recreate different aspects of reality. And so how that depiction was shown in science fiction and how that evolved. And then also just all the ways that these variety of different design disciplines are being fused together in an interesting way. And so there's a lot of questions that are being asked throughout the course of this. And I think as people who are teaching it, it's definitely worth taking a look at this as a textbook to cover kind of an intro 101 from a human rights ethics-based approach to design and spatial design for spatial computing. So Human Spatial Computing, it's around $135 right now. So it's priced as a textbook, but it's really rich and we'll be kind of giving a bit of an overview of all the variety of different things that are within the book on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Roshanae and Doug happened on Thursday, February 19th, 2026. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
Hi, everyone. I am Roshanae Gilbert. I am a industry associate professor at New York University in the Tandon School of Engineering in the Integrated Design and Media program. And a few years back, I started in XR when I worked beside an AR company in a WeWork and did some UX work with them and user research with them, and then ended up co-creating two courses for NYU's Tandon Online for VR, AR, and that was fun. And I said, you know, I want to research XR in general, and especially for people who have disabilities. So I started doing research, and I have a research class that is ongoing called Defining Accessible XR. So I do research. And then on top of that, I met Doug back in 2019 when I did a design residency at Falling Water, where he was one of the co-leads of that event. And I think a couple of years later, I was like, hey, I want to do a book. And he's like, I want to do it with you. And so we worked on this book, Human Spatial Computing, and that's what got us here today. So in general, I teach user experience design, assistive technology courses, and other things related to product. This semester, I'm teaching an assistive tech class around blindness, low vision, and also an agile product design. So, yeah.
Nice.
And I'm Doug Northcook. I'm the CEO and creative director at Creature. We have an XR game studio. We put out our first game at the end of 2024 called Starship Home, which is a mixed reality game that turns your living room into a spaceship that then takes off and takes you on a pretty wild adventure. But we also run a publishing label as well. We now publish 12 other studios, including that same year in 2024, we shipped the Apple Vision Pro Game of the Year, Thrasher, and the MetaQuest Game of the Year, Maestro. And we have, I think, 5 games coming out this year. And before that, I was at a company called Robot Teddy, where I was helping to run over a dozen VR and non-VR game projects there. And before that, I was also a university professor at Chatham University, where I was working on immersive technology and started an undergraduate program focused on immersive design there that is still running now, which is great. And so I've been in and around the space for quite a while. And I've also been here on the podcast a few times over the last decade as well. So it's nice to be back.
Yes. Yes. Welcome back. And I have had each of you on the podcast before, and we've got a little bit context of your background and journey. And I'd recommend folks check out previous conversations to dig into there. I want to hop right into this book because there's a lot to dive into, this Human Spatial Computing book. And I first wanted to point out that typically I see a lot of books that are either coming purely from the academic side and then haven't seen as much from the practitioner side. I know, Doug, you've been one foot of teaching, but also you're now in this space of being on the front lines of producing and creating content. And so you've got a more embodied experience of those design ideas and practices and what needs to be known. And Regine, I know that you're also coming from user experience, user design, ethics, accessibility. And so maybe you could just sort of give me a high level overview of the origins of this project and how you went about this process of collaborating and how you wanted to put all this information that you would want to somebody who was approaching XR design or human spatial computing in a way that you wanted to address the many variety of things that you have included in this book.
Yeah, I think, we started brainstorming virtually because we don't live in the same place. And then Doug came to New York and we got to work out of our studio where we have a motion capture studio and the Brooklyn Navy Yard. So we got to work out of there and do further brainstorming about what we wanted to do, how we wanted to put these chapters together. Doug had a lot of ideas around embodiment. I had ideas around ethics. We both wanted something that was not tied to the technology of the time, but something that could be a bit evergreen, which I think when you're thinking about the human side of things, that's what this book is. And it was really difficult where we were like, oh, we don't want to add that thing because, you know, I had Mozilla Hubs in there and there's no Mozilla Hubs anymore, right? So there were a lot of things, and I'd love to hear from Doug's perspective because he got us in to do a scholar in residence at Falling Water as well. So that was part of the creative process.
Yeah, so Regina and I met, which she mentioned, when she came out to the Falling Water Immersive Design Residency, which is a design residence program that I ran for several years at Falling Water, the Frank Lloyd Wright house that's here outside of Pittsburgh where I live. And the intention of that event was really to bring people working on XR and on immersive technology out into the woods with no technology to be able to have deeper discussions about how you actually do this work in a way that is a little bit more grounded in the human experience and not just in the affordances of the technology itself. And I think part of that is that when Regine was there, I think the two of us really connected about that, about the core underlying idea that there are some really powerful things about this technology, that it invites us back into our bodies in a way that the smartphone doesn't and the laptop doesn't, but also that there's a lot of complications there when you try to consider that everyone's bodies and the way that they interface with these technologies is radically different from an accessibility perspective, but also from just a human experience perspective. And a question that we kept coming back to a lot and is very much reflected in the last chapter of the book is this question of who do we want to become? And that the technologies that we choose to invite all the way into our lives start to shape and change our relationships with each other, our relationships with ourselves. And I think very few technologies have the ability to do that transformative work in the way that XR does, where you're actually able to choose the body that you're bringing to life when you're in a virtual environment, that maybe that body is you, maybe you're role-playing as someone else, maybe you're a different creature entirely. And so Falling Water invited Regine and I back because I'd mentioned that we were working on this book, and they brought us back to the property and let us stay there for about a week, I think. And that's really where we built the full outline for what became the rest of this book, which was really that we kind of both were like, all right, these are the few topics we want to go really deep in. And we kind of divvied those out, worked with each other to kind of outline the high level. And then we each went off and wrote individual chapters and then collaborated to try to edit those back down into something that works as a whole. But I think my hope was really to give people a tool with which to self-reflect on why you should use this technology. And if you're going to, how should you think about it? And I think in a lot of ways, like the book has become, it's like a snapshot of me and Regine's conversations and then us going off and monologuing ourselves about some of those things. And so it's funny because we finished writing most of the core of what this book is almost 2 years ago, maybe even a little longer. And the editing process with our publisher just took quite a while, which is pretty typical for academic presses. But what that meant is that, you know, the reality is like, I don't think either of us would write the same book today. We would write a completely different book. But I think what I've enjoyed going back through is that I do think there's a lot there that does invite a lot of questions, and that I do still have, I have all of the same questions about what this technology will do to us over time.
Mm. Yeah, one of the things I was struck with by reading it was that, well, first of all, there's so many different design disciplines that are coming into XR. And so there's a lens of each of those, but also in terms of ethics and the boundaries of, usually when I have been covering XR, there's ethical transgressions. And then it's like, okay, how do you get a framework around that? But I feel like that overall, this book has a, like a center of gravity of human rights, of trying to come up with like, what are the universal principles that we want to strive for, both from a universal design perspective, accessibility, diversity, equity, inclusion, which, you know, there's a interesting dialectic there. And they're like, what if that's illegal in the United States, but it's mandated in Europe? And so there's these weird political realities of our world that are collapsing onto this as well, as I read through this. And I was like, wow, EU regulations versus what's happening in the United States may actually be in direct contradiction to each other. So I'm wondering, if you start with the first chapter of ethics, which is trying to kind of lay out the overall landscape. And I feel like the EU has a very human rights approach of trying to define their laws. And the US is basically like, well, let's just let the companies do whatever they want. And then you mentioned the Codling Ridge dilemma at some point, which is that you want to let them innovate. And at some point, if you wait too long, then it's too late to do anything. And so there's this kind of like magical window where you could potentially do something, but you have to act fast and government's extremely slow. And so the end result is that nothing happens and you just let the companies do whatever they want, which means that all of the ethical design decisions are left to the designer, and like there's no laws to protect us here in the United States. And so, you know, this is a book that's trying to allow people to kind of understand the landscape, but also at the same time, we don't have much help from the US government, but in the EU, we actually do. So just love to hear any reflections on that, and starting with ethics, because in some ways the designers are on the front lines of trying to make those right decisions, even if there aren't regulations to force it.
Yeah, that, I mean, we went back and forth on how we should start the book from a historical perspective or with ethics. And I thought, you know, Doug and I had a conversation about like, what should we do? And I said, I really feel like ethics should be the foundation of the book. Like this should be the first chapter. And then everything else is built off of that. And ethics depends on context always, right? And one of the things that happened in the course of us writing this book is the European Union released the European Accessibility Act. And then we have in the United States, the Americans with Disability Act, we have Section 508. All of these things require us to make things more accessible. We saw lawsuits with VR that we hadn't seen before happening over the course of the time that we were writing the book as well. And then we saw a new administration come in into the United States stating that diversity, equity, and inclusion are, you know, we're not going to have these things anymore. You know, we're making this executive order. So that did create this real life contradiction of where things are getting rolled back in the United States and then things are moving forward in the European Union with the European Accessibility Act. Now, with all of this stuff, it's always slow. And one of the things in that first chapter, as a former IT project manager, I used to look at risk. And to me, one of the things we're not doing with all of this stuff is we're not looking at risk. We're not making risk registers. We're not looking at ways to mitigate these risks. The funny thing is, in that first chapter, I talk about how somebody broke into the Meta Ray-Bans and was using it for facial recognition. Now we're seeing that this is a real life possibility that I couldn't have predicted that an actual company would be like, yeah, use these glasses possibly for these these things. So it's an interesting place to be. I think a very exciting place to be, to see what opportunities we have to make things better. And it is very difficult when you're inside of an organization, you have to follow, you want to keep your job, right? And one of the things that I think makes this book a little different, it is, you know, more geared toward being like a textbook, but we do have scenarios and questions at the end of every chapter, because we want you to read, but we also want you to think. And the way that, you know, for me as an educator and what I've done within corporations, within institutions, is I like to ask questions because I can't teach you anything. All I can do is ask questions, and hopefully that'll make you think.
Yeah, there's a lot of really great questions throughout the course of this. And like you said, at the chapter, but also throughout the entirety of the book, it's really in this kind of Socratic dialogue where you're being asked to ponder how would you approach this or that. And Doug, it seems like that you likely had the first chapter of the story of human-computer interaction, where I was really surprised to see how far back you go to set the context, but also really appreciated the references to science fiction, because I feel like science fiction is an area where a lot of these ideas first emerge. So it's interesting to trace back some of these ideas and how then they get borne out into technology many, many years later. So it's kind of a unique way of starting to tell the history of this technology to go back to even before there was like electricity up until like
Yes.
science fiction. So I'd love to hear you kind of like, where do you begin when you tell the story of human computer interaction?
Yeah, sure. I think that chapter was probably the most unexpected for me, in part because it wasn't even something that was really part of our original outline. And I think as Reginae and I got deeper into our discussions about a lot of this, about like the context of how we're thinking about ethics and about design and transformation, it really highlighted to me. I was like, I think we need to try to get the deeper context of how we even got here. And also, again, is like, why did we get here? Like, what have we been looking for as humans that have brought us to this place? And so I was like, let me see where the thread goes as I start to pull it, because, you know, my original view didn't go back really beyond like the 1960s when you had Ivan Sutherland and some of these early inventors that were trying to create these impossible early immersive headsets that were very rudimentary. But that led me, you know, going from Sutherland and some of the people working at MIT and some of the other research labs in the 60s and 70s, that they were piggybacking on work that was done by Charles Wheatstone, who was this English inventor in the 1800s, who created the stereogram, which is the viewer headset where you have a basically a slightly offset stereo photograph card that's split down the middle. And so you're able to get a slight stereo effect from a still image. And I found a bunch of Wheatstone's original papers where he describes like how he arrived at those equations, and that his core insight had actually come from Da Vinci's treatise on painting. And so there's this thread that goes back, right? Which is that all of this is about us getting closer and closer to the ability to be able to recreate the human experience through increasingly elaborate illusions, right? That's what Da Vinci was trying to do. That's what Wheatstone was trying to do. And all of that, right, is like everyone has been trying to do this for centuries, right? Whether it's painting or sculpture or VR or AR, right? And we're still on that path. But I think the big piece there is that like the depth of thinking about what this technology can do and what it is for is not isolated to the last 10 years of development by three technology companies, right? That this goes back hundreds of years and is really just an extension of our broad human experience, which is why, you know, the book, I think, kind of ranges into these different spaces from architecture and history and ethics to try to craft the ability for people to try to form their own cohesive understanding for themselves of what this technology is for.
And love to hear you maybe elaborate a little bit more on some of the early, like 1909 science fiction of this kind of idea of always being connected, and then Gibson's Neuromancer, 1984, and then Snow Crash, 1992, from Neal Stephenson. So you have these visions of the future that are also helping to influence how this is all unfolding.
To me, that's one of the more fascinating parts of kind of how we ended up where we are now. There's this incredible novella that's written by E.M. Forster. I think it's in 1908. And he writes this novella called The Machine Stops, which is an imagining of basically like the internet and smartphones and video calling, all of that in 1908. And he paints a very grim picture of basically that we are all connected by this elaborate machine. No one wants to go outside. No one wants to sit with each other in person. They just want to stay in their homes and consume all things through this little like glowing portal. And when you read it, you're just like, oh my God, like how did he see it? And it's like he doesn't see the technology very clearly, but he does see the human propensity for isolationism and disconnection and the desire of the wealthy and powerful to use that as a mechanism to control society, right? And that is something that is then picked up by every other science fiction author through the rest of that century until today, including in Ready Player One and Snow Crash. And I think it's very interesting, right? There's these stories of like the early Oculus days when Palmer Luckey and some of those people were bringing about the modern age of VR over the last 15 or so years, and that they were giving a copy of Ready Player One to everyone at the company and saying, like, this is where we're going. We're trying to build this. When Ready Player One is like a horrific depiction of the toxicity of nostalgia and how it obliterates culture. Right. And then they get acquired by Meta, and their goal is to consume human attention on the planet and monetize it. Right. Which is like, it is E.M. Forrester's machine. It is the machine that must be stopped. Right. And I think there's such an interesting thread that can be drawn there, which is the obsession with dystopian science fiction as utopian science fiction by leaders of a lot of tech companies. And I think that to me is like a very important piece of this broad story, right? Which is that not everyone is invested in the same vision of what humans could become. They're much more interested in what they can become as an individual and not as interested in society as a whole. And I think that was something Reg and I both kept coming back to, is that like we want to try to give people a way to like step outside and view all of us together and like what could it mean if we all go there together?
And I feel like that what comes to mind is the just being at ITVA Doc Lab this year in Amsterdam, the International Documentary Film Festival of Amsterdam, and they have their emerging technology selection that always has a selection of XR, AI, AR. But their theme this year was off the internet because so many artists were reflecting upon the internet and where we've come and how we live in this algorithmic reality and that we want to be connected and embodied and with each other. And so there's other initiatives that are going to be seeing how XR technologies can reinvigorate civic participation and actually gather people together face to face. And so having the technology kind of mediate these social relations because we are so isolated in our worlds. And so, yeah, I was just really struck by some of the science fiction references that haven't been a part of my awareness of the history. But yeah, there's those science fiction authors that have called different dimensions of where we're at right now, that it's great to tie it all together. And speaking of what connects us all, the third chapter of storytelling, you know, this is something that I've been very interested in covering. About a third of my coverage of the Voices of VR has been going to Sundance New Frontier, Tribeca Immersive, South by Southwest Immersive, Venice Immersive, and ITVA Doc Lab and other regional festivals around the world that are really focusing on the power of storytelling to show the extent of what you can do with immersive technologies. And so Originate, is this a chapter that you wrote? I'd love to hear you talk
Yeah,
a little
so
bit more around storytelling.
I think storytelling is the most important thing we have because, you know, what I tell my students is like, it'll get you the guy, it'll get you the gal, it'll get you the job, right? Storytelling is everything. And we've seen it repeatedly. And with immersive technologies, with XR, with AR, with VR, with all of it, it's the stories, right? It's the stories that get people coming back to a game over and over again. They want to finish the story. They want to, you know, be able to share that. And so the idea with that chapter was to tell a story. And we started with, you know, Estella's story. And her story is a compelling one. She went through a really tough time, but she turned that into artwork using both augmented reality and virtual reality. And using a physical space, which I really liked as well. So it wasn't just being in an immersive environment, it was being in this physical space that you could interact with and explore her story. And then also getting to tell stories of other cultures, because I feel like the tendency is we just see things from America or from Europe, but you know, we're not thinking about, you know, indigenous folks from New Zealand, which I was, you know, had the pleasure of getting to tell some of that story and how they used augmented reality working with Meta to tell the story of the Maori gods. So it was fun to write that because it gave me opportunity to learn about perspectives and storytelling, ways of storytelling that I wasn't aware of. And then being able to share the way that stories could be told, different stories could be told in using these technologies.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
And Doug also helped me with like forming this together and saying, oh, you should bring in this and that. So it was really, really good. One of the ones I had more fun writing, I would say.
Yeah, Doug, do you have any comments on, you know, obviously storytelling in terms of the games and stuff that you're producing? I think that ends up being a strong hook, but love to hear any other thoughts that you have on storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, this is something we talked about quite a bit and something I've been talking about with a lot of the studios that I work with is that, you know, I think XR has this incredible power to tell stories. But I think what we've seen emerge in the last like 3-4 years is that so much of what especially younger people are drawn to in XR is not being told a story, but being a story. And I think you see that in like the success of something like Gorilla Tag, where like I was able to work with Karastel, the creator of Gorilla Tag, early on for a little while. And he has such a deep insight into this, which is that it's really about giving the player just enough that the world just unfolds before them. And in Gorilla Tag, it's that you are Monkey. Like you are in this weird body where you're walking on your hands and you have to learn how to be that person. And then you would start encountering other people and the players tell story. They go on an adventure and they learn how to climb and they meet a new friend and that friend makes a joke. And then they start relating that, right? They tell a story about their experience. And I think those have become the things that are bringing people back the most is that they can be a part of a story. They can be a part of someone else's experience. And that is this kind of infectious behavior that has really been like the bolstering success of XR as a technology over the last 2-3 years is social dynamic, emergent behavior and storytelling that emerges just between players, right? That it's not scripted by the designer and there is no end, right? It is just an extension of the ever unfolding storytelling that has been with humans forever, right? It's just playing out in the digital realm. And I think that's something that caught a lot of people by surprise, because I think most people over the age of, you know, 20 have never been a part of that because it's mostly the domain of the young. But I've gotten to spend a significant amount of time in that space, which is both terrifying, but also endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. And I think it's part of one of the generation gaps that I feel in terms of like, I don't know, it's certainly a part of where XR is taking off in the youth in a way that was surprising for a lot of people from my generation, the X generation. And I've had a conversation with Karastel as well. And there's a lot of deep visionary ways of kind of understanding the affordances of the medium and how that is playing out with using your body to locomote and just all the ways that they have the narrative design and everything. One of the things I wanted to bring out in this chapter was it was really striking to me just to see also this view from the lens of neurodivergence and having diversity of different ways that people process information and how by doing universal design principles and taking in consideration, it actually forces people to think around how they're telling their story in a way that may have multiple entry points. And so wondering, Regina, if you can kind of elaborate on some of those points that you're also bringing out in this chapter.
Yeah, I think, you know, people will say, well, oh, you know, I created this thing. And it's like, well, what if you can't see the thing? Then how does someone experience it, right? If they're not able to see it, can they hear it? Is there a tactile experience that goes along with it? You know, I've done a little bit of advising around, you know, different exhibits where people are like, well, how can I make this AR thing, you know, more accessible? And I said, well, can you have an audio description of what that thing is? Right? There are ways, I think, that we tend to look at things with one lens. And that's something that I think creators, one of the beautiful things, and one of the things I think in general as humans we're weak at is our imaginations. And so I think this is something we could all strengthen. And one way to strengthen that is thinking about what are the other ways someone could experience something? Because there's not ever just one way. Right. And I love like Octavia Butler, the science fiction writer, who was like, if there's a question, there's 1,000 answers to that, not just one. And so I think that when we as creators can look at something and go, you know what, I can offer other ways of experiencing this thing, right? You know, when you're thinking about even with sound, how is somebody experiencing that sound? What if they can't experience that sound? What can they experience? They can still experience a vibration. They could feel some, have a sensation with their body. There are other ways that creators can make experiences. It doesn't just have to be one way.
Yeah, and I also just want to mention at this point that there was the XR Access that was an entity that was doing a lot of really amazing work. And unfortunately, with the funding cutbacks, with the slashing of all diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility funding from the federal government, the XR Access had to close shop. I think they're still maybe doing some research, but they don't have an entity that's self-contained anymore, which I think is very sad, but they've done a lot of great work and had a lot of great, amazing gatherings and bringing the community together. And so I expect the work to continue, but maybe just under other umbrellas. But yeah, just wanted to mention that.
And the GitHub repository is still existing. So if people are looking to make things accessible, you can still go and look there. So that there's the resources are still available, but unfortunately, XR Access is not working the way it used to. So it made me really, really sad to hear that, and especially Dylan, I adore. So Dylan Fox is an amazing person.
Yeah. And so moving on to the next chapter, the universal design for spatial computing, and there's seven different principles. Principle one, equitable use. Principle two, flexibility in use. Principle three, simple and intuitive use. Number four, perceptible information. Number five, tolerance for error. Number six, low physical effort. Seven, size and space for approach and use. So yeah, I'd love to hear a little bit more around these universal design principles as you start to dig into each of these.
Yeah. So this was something early on that I knew that I wanted to include in here. And Reshna and I talked about quite a bit, in part because I had been doing some work around this, working to embed some of these principles with some of the early studios that I was working with when I first started working in XR. And so universal design is a design framework that is still very primarily used in architecture. And so, in the design and layout and affordances of physical spaces. But I think what is so great about this framework is really like the underlying principle of universal design is that if you make something work for anyone, what you are doing is you are making it more adaptable and more usable for everyone. And I think that is such an easy thing to overlook. And something that Reshna and I both talked frequently about was our own experience with not having full use of our senses or our body at different points, right? Like I've had a variety of like foot and ankle injuries over the last decade, or even I have friends who suffer from severe migraines and low vision, right? A whole range of things that, especially when we're talking about XR, right, that XR is a much closer comparison to design for architecture than it is for like smartphones, because in architecture, you're designing for human bodies in physical space and often in larger spaces. And that's not true of most human computer interaction design. It's much more an interface design. And this is more of an embodied design. And so, you know, a lot of what Regine was just saying is that if you do the work of invention, you can actually find ways of accommodating not just a wider range of users, but a wider range of use cases. And so I think a great example of this is something like audio descriptions, and also of just visual descriptions and cues and subtitling. And a big thing with that I would often use with developers is that, okay, you have a game that you're making that relies on a character talking to you and telling you to do something. And it's like, okay, if that happens, what if I'm not listening to what that character is saying? Are they going to repeat it? Am I going to see it? What if I have the volume turned all the way down? What if you're demoing your game in a large exhibit hall and there's people screaming and shouting all around, right? And part of that is like, you might have this very specific vision in your head of what the game is like, but if you're only ever testing those things with people that have the same range of abilities that you have, if it only stays within your team, you're not just missing like a huge cross-section of users, you're actually missing a huge cross-section of the audience for your project. And I think nowhere more has this become clear to us that we were working on a project with a game studio a couple of years ago, and we went to our hardware partners who manufacture the devices that we were going to release this game on, and we asked them if they would pull user data for us on the number of players that play all games seated on the platform. And the number was well over 50% of users play every single experience, whether it's designed to be played or not, seated. And no designer that I was talking to at that time was thinking about that at all. Everyone is, I think, still mostly obsessed with full body, full range of motion, very typical, like they're still using the Vitruvian man, the 6 foot tall, fully able-bodied man is the archetype around design. But that is, in fact, not most people on the planet. And that if you design for this very narrow cross-section, like you will not have a wide audience. You might find a very narrow audience. You know, you see that with even something like Gorilla Tag or some of these like super high velocity, high intensity applications, but they're mostly played by people, you know, that are very young and can handle the visceral intensity. But most everybody else is playing seated, even if it's not meant to be. And I think that was pretty eye-opening for us. We're like, wow, we haven't been considering seated play as a primary use case, when in fact it is the primary use case for all of these devices. Doesn't mean you can't also try to encourage people who are able to stand up and do high intensity physical activity, but that if that's the only thing you're designing for, then you're not understanding the real behavior that people are exhibiting when they're using this technology. And so I think that's what I tried to do in this chapter, is kind of lay out the core of the principles and give examples of when you're doing this work, how are you thinking about it? And I think some of them are very clear examples, like tolerance for error, is that if your application is very fragile and can't hold up to people just like walking across the room to a place that they shouldn't be, it's like the player is always going to do everything that they shouldn't do. They're going to do everything that you don't want them to do. And you have to not just anticipate that, you have to design for it. And you have to design to try to encourage them back to your kind of acceptable behaviors. But I think more often than not, that's a losing battle when you have someone inside of a headset in a virtual world, because they're there and you're not there with them, looking over their shoulder, able to tell them what to do. Right. So, but yeah, but that was kind of the general approach here, was in part, right? Like universal design is a very complete framework. And I think there is, you know, a near one-to-one overlay that can be done that I think is enormously helpful.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And it's just interesting, again, how XR is bringing in all these different design disciplines, because there's game design, there's embodiment, there's architecture and neuroscience and all these that you're covering throughout the course of this book. So the next chapter of Merging Human Creativity and Technology, I found this was interesting in the sense where you're essentially asking a fundamental question of, what does it mean to be human? And there's these fundamental qualities of ability, choices, communication, compassion, creativity, curiosity, emotions, intelligence, language, and social. And that you're taking each of these different qualities of both experience, but also these character traits and these dimensions of what it means to be human, and looking at it through a variety of these different lens, the systematic lens, cultural lens, social lens, individual lens, and internal lens. And so you're taking each of these character traits and then looking at it, all these different contextual domains, and then asking questions about each of those. So I'd love to hear how this chapter came about.
Yeah, so the chapter came about because I've been teaching UX for quite some time. And, you know, when students are like, they want to jump in whatever tool of the day, you know, it used to be Sketch, now it's Figma, right? Or Adobe Photoshop, whatever. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to start us off with a question. What does it mean to be human? Right. And over the years, after asking that question repeatedly at the start of the semester, patterns started to emerge. And from that, that's where I came up with a list of things. Like, these are the areas I think we should look at for the book. And, you know, Doug was, you know, like, yeah, let's, you know, these are good. So we looked at this list. And then what I did was, like, I want to apply lenses to them, because I think when we're creating these immersive experiences, we're not just creating it from, okay, we want to make this game, but how are we thinking about this game? We have to market it. We have to sell it. People have to play it. We want people across cultures to play. You know, there isn't just like, oh, we're going to make this thing. And I mean, yeah, some people still do that. We're going to make this thing and throw it out there in the world. But you have to think beyond, we want to make this thing. You have to think about, Who's going to use it? How are they going to be using it? Where are they going to be using it? How are we going to sell it? Who are we selling it to? Right. So I think when we approach experiences, looking at it from a human perspective and then applying these lenses, nothing is just one way, right? Things are layered. And so I think that applying that is really helpful from a creator's perspective.
I think when Regine started working on this chapter, and we had, and Regine asked me that question, which is, what does it mean to be human? And I think this was what was so great, I think, about this process and our collaboration, is that like that specific chapter and that specific question ended up guiding a lot of the way that I was thinking about my own writing, and really like landed me at the question of like, okay, what does it mean to be human? And it's like, okay, but who are we going to become from this? And I think what I've already heard from a couple of friends of mine who have bought the book and already finished it is that this kind of moving back and forth between things that are very like tangible and practical from like a design perspective of like, hey, if you're using this specific piece of technology, think about it this way, to the bigger, grander questions of like, what does it mean to be human? And that like you must be able to do both of those things, because as you put it earlier, Kent, like the boundaries barely exist for this technology in terms of like who's monitoring it and who's legislating it and who's defining what the guidelines are. And that as a designer, I believe that you have a responsibility to do good and to make things in the world that are aspirational to the people consuming them. And I think oftentimes it's easy to just make something that you think will make money and not take into consideration the rest of this, which is like the real work of trying to be a part of society, especially of a global society, right? Because these are global products that are played by people all over the world, all different kinds of people, all different ages. And there's so much in there that needs to be considered, which is incredibly daunting, especially if you're like a solo developer and you need to try to be a psychologist and an architect and a neuroscientist, right? But really, it's like you just have to get enough pieces from all of that so that you're just asking the right questions.
And I think right now in this moment, there's a huge AI hype that's happening right now that is also trying to dissolve the boundaries of what it means to be human. Because if they are able to have AI technologies be perceived to be as powerful as humans, then it sort of devalues what it means to be human. And so I think asking the questions about what it means to be human around connections, context, emotions, these relationships that we have that are deep meaning and way that we're embedded in a context that is relational and communal. So I think those different types of things are also important from the context of the AI narrative that is trying to turn the human into a computer. And if they turn a human into a computer, then they can just say that this technology is so powerful, pattern matching way beyond what humans can do. And so you have this kind of battle that is being pushed forth by the technology companies that is trying to blur the lines about what it means to be human. So I think this chapter is really important to revisit this, not only in the context of XR design, but also the narratives that are being propagated by people who are trying to sell us AI technologies by propagating AI and devaluing humans.
I'll take that in one slightly different direction, which is that I think that what is happening is not necessarily turning humans into computers, but turning humans into robots, right? The goal of a lot of this technology development is not to make us the machine, but to make us the thing that the machine operates, which I think is such an interesting distinction, especially as we're thinking about XR, because from my view, like the dystopian version of this technology, right, that I would say several companies are very invested in developing, is that a head-mounted display that is able to see what you're seeing and also show you other things is the device that has the greatest propensity for human control, right? Because not only can it give you things, it is actively consuming the world around you and is able to conform how it's trying to operate you, right? It's the interface for the human operating system. And it's something that I think increasingly, as we worked on this book, I would say I became increasingly concerned about the direction of this technology and the possibility and maybe inevitability that the companies that are the most heavily invested in this technology are not necessarily interested in a lot of the things that Regine and I tried to put into this book. So I think part of that is my hope that some of those people read this book and maybe develop a tiny bit of additional empathy for the end users of these products.
Now, Regina, I don't know if you have any other comments on the AI dimension, but also this tendency for technology companies to blur the lines of what it means to be human and reminding us what it means to be human in terms of how we even talk about the technology, but also design experiences that are not dehumanizing.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, well, first I want to talk about the fear that people have with AI. I think that there's a legitimate fear that people have that they'll be replaceable, and they're not, right? When I was writing this book, actually, I had one of my students read a chapter, and she read the chapter and she said, I think it's good, but I could just learn that on ChatGPT. It was like a step, you know, it really did not feel good. And from that point on, though, I said, okay, what can I write? What can I teach? What can I workshop? What can I do that AI can't? And this is something that I have done ever since. Ever since she told me that, I was like, I'm going to do everything that AI can't. And so last night, actually, I had my students working on a project. They were talking about ableism. They were talking about not using the words inclusion, accessibility, disability. I said, you're going to talk about these things, but not use those words, right? I had them create a whole map, a systems map. At the end, I asked, do you think AI could have created this? They all said no. And I said, I want you to remember something. You can do things that AI cannot. You have lived experience that AI does not. And the one thing it can never replicate is someone's lived experience. And we all have different lived experiences, which makes our imaginations, again, that muscle that I think we can build, so great. Now, I do see a danger with the AI decreasing our use of our imaginations, but it can never replace our lived experience. Me just riding on the subway coming into work today, AI doesn't know that. It could, you know, make a pattern recognition. It doesn't know what performer came on and did its thing, you know, did their thing and all this stuff. You're not getting that, right? Whereas that's where the creativity can come in with these immersive technologies, and what people can create is people's lived experiences, in my opinion. So although the fear is there, I still have such great hope for us in our humanity that we can use this AI as a tool, which is what it is, and not use it as a replacement, which it is not, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I think the other piece here is that we started writing this book kind of before ChatGPT was even released.
Yeah.
And so by the end of the book, and this is where I'm sure we'll get to this in the last chapter, is like, it was like Regina and I started talking a lot about like, okay, where is all of this going and where is the convergence? And I'm still convinced, and I think this is why XR to me feels inevitable as a like globally adopted technology, is that it is the perfect form factor for AI integration. And every company developing it knows that more now than ever, which is both terrifying because of the pace that they're moving at. But I think also like there is like some amount of hopefulness in there as well, I think.
Yeah, well, let's move to the next chapter of the body, because I think this is an area where XR and spatial computing really is introducing things that may not be already integrated in a lot of other design disciplines. And so really understanding the body, proprioception, sensory experiences. And I think there's been a lot of work coming from the place illusion, plausibility illusion, these different ideas around the neuroscience of what's happening with XR and embodiment. So yeah, I'd love to hear a little bit more around trying to encapsulate this new vector of design, which is really paying attention to the body and how you're doing different modulation of the sensory experience as a part of this experiential design.
Yeah. This was something when we were doing outlining, I was like, okay, I know this is one of the things that I'm going to want to go deep on and tackle. And this is, I think, why I've been so drawn into this technology the whole time, which is I think it is both hilarious and delightful to do computing using your body, using your whole body as the input mechanism, in part because it's an unbelievable design problem to solve because everyone's meat is different, right? Even just down to like the size of your hands and how a controller feels in your hand, or when you're playing something purely with hand tracking, like what does that feel like to you? Because the answer is it feels different to you than it feels to me. for so many reasons, both how your body is actually shaped and how it functions, to how deep your own sense of your body is in space. And so I think my hope for this chapter was kind of twofold. One was to kind of highlight the importance and the possibility space there. And the other is just to introduce people to some conceptual ways of thinking about the body and about sensory information that I think often are not immediately aware to people that are just working in technology. And so you mentioned proprioception, Kent, which to me is like one of the most interesting things about VR in particular. Proprioception being your sense of your body in space, right? And so it's kind of your muscles and your skeletal system and your brain working together, right? You stick your arm out to the side, you close your eyes, and then you touch your nose with your pointer finger. And your body can just do that because your body knows where it is in space, right? It's how you're able to reach behind your back and grab something that you know where it is. But I think what's so magical in VR is that you can alter someone's proprioception and you can give them a different sense of what their body is. Not just what their body is, but whether or not they have a body at all, whether or not that is a human body. I think the closest connection that I think most people understand is that when you're driving a car, you have a really good sense. If you've been driving for decades, you know where the car is, you know where the edges of the car are, and you're controlling the car with your body, but you have a sense of the exact scale of the machine that lives outside of your body. And so in that way, you are functionally detaching your brain from your body and putting it into the machine. And there's some amazing VR experiences that do this, right? Whether you're piloting a giant mech and you're going and fighting and you have arms that are twice as long as your regular arms, eventually you get that sense of proprioception where you're actually able to hit things with pinpoint accuracy because you have put your body into a virtual machine. One of my favorite things that we did in Starship Home, our last game, and this came from an early conversation with one of the junior people on our team, Carson, who's a former student of mine. He came to me with this idea. He was like, Doug, what if your arms were so long that they started to bend against the wall of the room that you're in? And I was just like, I love it. It's going in the game. And so we made this entire sequence where your arms become incredibly long and they're wiggly and stretchy, and then they start to slap against the walls. And it's just this very delightful thing to play with because you're like, oh yeah, what if my arms were longer? And what would that feel like? And VR is a way to play with that, to play with embodiment in a way that we get very few opportunities to in the rest of our life. And to me, it's a space to play with concepts that can be purely delightful and magical, but also is where I think the most danger lives as well. And I think part of what we get into in this chapter and in other places in the book is the danger of bringing your body inside of the computer, especially when you have other people that want to infringe on the space in which your body exists. And it might not be a real body, right? But it can be very uncomfortable if people are standing too close to you, especially if you're in a scenario where someone is, right? There's some studies and some information we bring into the book about sexual harassment and very aggressive behavior in social VR spaces. And you feel that so much more intensely because it feels like you are there. It feels as if my body is in this space. This person is standing too close to me. And in a lot of cases, I can't even physically push them away. I don't actually have the same capabilities to exit that I do in the real world. I can't push them. I can't move myself as quickly or easily because maybe I'm not even as skilled at moving a body in that world as I am in the real world. And so you have some of this very real danger that can live for players, I think, especially for younger users when you are bringing your body into an unsafe space, right? And I think that's where this other layer of designer responsibility exists, is that you are creating very intimate, very physically intense, very emotionally intense experiences just by someone putting on the headset. Like, that's already happening. And so if you're not doing everything that you can to ensure safety, but in particular safety for minors, then you are doing what I would consider to be like egregious behavior. You are not doing the work that is the bare minimum responsibility of designers that also certainly exists at a platform level, at a legislative level. Since there is no meaningful legislation and the platforms have very little guidance, it really is up to individual designers to implement what I would consider like bare minimum body safety protocols into multi-user experiences. But this is an area I've spent a lot of time working on, and I spend a lot of time working with studios on, which is, how does it feel to be a body in the thing that you're building? And something that, like, I have a ton of additional work that I'm always trying to do on. But yeah, that's some of where we went in this chapter.
Yeah. And one follow-on comment that I would just make is that I know that Mel Slater has his kind of illusionary approach of, like, the place illusion, plausibility illusion. And David Chalmers has actually critiqued that in his book, Reality Plus, where he's saying that just because it's in a virtual environment doesn't make it not real. And he's coming at from more of a perspective of, what if we live in a simulation, then everything that we experience is going to be real to some extent. But I think you can also point to some of the studies that you also cite from Jessica Outlaw. I had a conversation with her. She was talking about how some of the surveys, that some of the transgression of our bodily boundaries within the context of a virtual environment can give the same type of physiological reactions through sexual assault, sexual harassment. Just because it's happening in a virtually mediated space doesn't make it less real. And I think with Slater and all of Western philosophies and this kind of substance metaphysics, is only real if it's physical, but there are these virtually mediated experiences that are mediated through technology, but can still have a real physical impact on us. And I think this paradigm shift into more process relational modes of thinking around the nature of these experiences that really focus on the human experience of it rather than if it's happening in physical reality or not. And I think this kind of extends out to harassment online in general. There's this kind of tendency to say, if it doesn't happen in physical reality, then it's not assault, it's not harassment. It's like less than if you were actually having it in physical reality. And so I feel like there's ways that there are glimmers that we're pointing to a new paradigm shift, but we're still trapped between this world of thinking things are in this hierarchy of reality based upon whether it's in physical reality or virtually mediated.
Absolutely. And I think especially for children, but also for people over the age of 18, the internet is a place to play at transgression because the consequences are not perceived to be real by the people inflicting that harm. And so because they do not perceive the consequences as real, they do not care, right? There's very little empathy, I think, on the part of people inflicting harm online. And I think in VR, it's even more extreme. And I think to your point, Kent, it's not about whether or not it is real. Because to me, right, that's a philosophical question that you can debate endlessly. It's really a matter of, does it feel real? Does it have an actual effect? Do you experience it as real hurt or further as trauma, as real intense trauma, especially for people that are already carrying some of that trauma with them, that it can be quite extreme.
Yeah, and Regina, I don't know if you had anything else you wanted to add to that point.
Oh, no. I mean, I think Doug really, he covered this chapter very well. It was a chapter he was very passionate, but like early on, it was like, I got to write about embodiment design. So it's a real, I think it's a really great chapter and really think all the things he said about using your body and being in your body and the impact that it has. I think, you know, there's a whole intent versus impact debate that goes on. And so when creators are creating something, what environments are you creating? What safeguards are you providing for folks with it so that they do and can feel safe in their bodies? No one should get in an immersive experience and not feel safe, right? I mean, at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And moving on to the chapter 7, we have affordances of immersive technology and the future of computing. And I really appreciated getting a little bit of the history of the word affordance. I think affordance is something I've been tossing around since I've been in XR. I think just people within the industry talk around affordances, around what something affords you, what you can do, what can you experience. But in this chapter, we really go into the origins from James J. Gibson's 1970 book, The Ecological Approach, but also this idea of signifiers, signaling what things may afford. And that, to me, has an associative link of semiotics and how there's a sign of a potential of all the different meanings of that potential. And then it's collapsed into one artifact, the fixed part. So that's purse's secondness. So the firstness is the potential, the secondness is the fixed, and the thirdness is the mediating from the person who's receiving it and being able to interpret what those signs are. And so there's a way of both a semiotic transmission that's happening with affordances, but also it speaks to agency in terms of what can you do with this, given this sign that we can do in physical reality. And so in this chapter, you're talking around those signifier aspects. And there was a quote I wanted to just read that was from Gibson that you had. Affordances determine what actions are possible, he writes.
Signifiers communicate where the action should take place, and we need both. That was from Norman from 2013. So I'd love to hear some of this elaboration of affordances and agency and also signifiers and communication.
Yeah. So I think this chapter was one that when Reg and I were starting to talk, I was just like, I just need to set the record straight. Like, that's what this chapter is for me, in part because like I've been in so many design talks over the years where someone uses the term affordances in a way that is just factually incorrect. And I think that's another part of like, I think what we try to do broadly with this book is to provide a grounding for some shared language for how we talk about the creation of these experiences. And that just that is, I think, like maybe worth it in doing is just like, if people leave with nothing else other than an understanding of the true definition of affordances, then like the book was worth it. But I think for me, like this has become one of the things that has stuck with me the most as a designer myself. And this runs through, I think, the whole book, which is that like we are all radically different, all of us, in every possible way. And I think the trap of thinking about affordances is that every object has a set amount and types of affordances, and that those are fixed states, to your point, Kent, right? That there's a way of thinking about like, there are affordances, full stop. And so I have this exercise that I have run at a few workshops, and I think it is like the project is defined at the end of this chapter, which is that I have two people sit together and I have them draw the same object. One of my favorite versions of this was that I had two people sit. It was an engineer from Google and a choreographer, and they both drew a backpack. That it was the Google engineer's backpack. And so they both draw the backpack, and then they have to diagram every single action that is possible to take with the backpack and do this large format diagrammatic drawing. They get about an hour, and then they have to make an exhaustive list of everything that can be done with the backpack. And at the end of that, the engineer had drawn a beautiful technical drawing of the backpack and diagrammed every single zipper and fastener and what they could each be used for. And the choreographer basically drew a series of landscape drawings of her going on adventures wearing the backpack, right? And so for her, it's like, the backpack affords me going on this adventure. And he was like, this specific zipper affords being unzipped. Right. And it's like, okay, they're both doing the exercise. And this is always the point of doing it, right? Is that it's like our perceptions of these objects are not the same. But when you're designing in the context of XR, right, you are fabricating an object that may exist in the real world, but it cannot function the way that it exists in the real world, because it's like, okay, great. We put a book. I think books are such a great example here. It's like, I put a book into a VR game. What affordances are we going to design into the book that people may expect to be able to do? Are we going to design the book to be able to be picked up and held? Am I going to design the book to be able to be opened? Am I going to design the book to be able to be burned? Am I going to design the book to be able to be eaten? Right? All the possible things that like anyone could choose if they so wished to do with a book in the real world. I could tear out a page of the book and I could eat that page. You can't stop me from doing that in the real world, but I can stop you from doing that in VR because I don't design that to be able to happen. And I think that's where, like, I think I talk in this chapter about Job Simulator and some of these other VR games where they've tried to get to an exhaustive amount of afforded detailing where objects have so many varied possibilities and often possibilities that don't exist in the real world. And to me, that's part of what is so exciting is that you can create new affordances. You can create new possibilities of how someone can interact with a familiar object, and you can also invent entirely new objects, which for me, that's where the most interesting work lives. And my team and I, we had so much fun on Starship Home designing a bunch of objects that don't exist in the real world, spaceship components and strange plants that react in strange ways when you interact with them. And I think there is a lot of possibility for exploration there, but also there is this required empathy that lives in really trying to understand, like, what is someone going to want to do with the objects that we put in front of them and with the experience as a whole, and then trying to allow them enough freedom to feel like the place that they are is actually real because I can relate to it and I can interact with it. without going to the exhaustive detail of pure simulation of every object, because that's out of scope and out of budget for most teams. Right. And so you kind of have to pick the lane of like, what level of richness are you trying to design for? Are you trying to get to realism, or are you trying to get to verisimilitude? Right. You're trying to get to the feeling of reality, but not reality itself. Or are you trying to go for magic? Right. And trying to understand what it is that you're going to allow as a possibility space.
Mm. Yeah. And I just wanted to elaborate a bit on what I meant by the fixed, elaborating on what Peirce is saying in his semiotics, but also process philosophy. So in process philosophy, there's what's possible, and those possibilities get collapsed into an actual actuality. And so there's a possibility space that's always larger than the actual space. And so Peirce kind of takes that idea, and the possibility is like the archetypal potentials of all the possibilities. And then it gets fixed into one of those actualities, which you could be taking the backpack on a hike would be one of the actual occasions of something that may be much more larger possibility space. And that the mediator is a triadic approach where you have a third person who's interpreting the signs and the signifiers of those. And so you're basically having that mediation happen. So in XR and design, you have these objects that represent these archetypal spaces that people know what a doorknob means normally. So you could try to open it. So you have this action that is afforded to you, and that part of the process of the communication is, you know, giving these signs and leading people towards what you might be able to do, but also creating a context so that you could have a trajectory through this. But that third part of the mediator is trying to understand what that object is in a fixed context and understanding what that possibility space is. And so I feel like there's a kind of the semiotic process that's happening. And anyway, I just wanted to kind of elaborate on that.
Norman talks about that as false affordances, right? That there is this list of perceived possibilities, right? That I perceive that this door can open, but it turns out it's not a door at all. It's just a doorknob bolted to the wall, right? And I think VR falls prey to this all of the time, where if you put too many objects into a scene and they are not all able to be interacted with, what you're doing is you're inviting basically a perpetual false affordance where you'll begin to lose trust with the user, because all of the things they expect to be able to do is like, if I can't pick up any of the books, like I'm going to get annoyed and then I will stop. And if there is a book that I'm actually supposed to pick up, I'm never going to do it, because I won't think that books afford being picked up in your world. And like, what kind of a world is that? So it's such an interesting space to play with, in part because it really is about trying to meet people where their expectations are, right? Which is, I expect to be able to do these things. And if I can't, then I'm going to be bummed. I'm going to be bummed out. And if someone's bummed out, they'll just take the headset off and then you've lost them, right? And the goal is to keep them engaged and to build trust. And I would say often to defy expectations, where there are affordances for objects that when the user discovers them, they're just like, oh my God, I cannot believe that this object does this thing that is unexpected that I was clever enough to find, right? I think that's often like the game design magic, is giving people that sense of wonder and awe that comes from them, oftentimes through a subtle signifier, to encourage them to interact with something that is genuinely afforded to them, that they don't feel is being signified to them, that they feel like they just discovered it. And that's my favorite kind of stuff to work on. It's like that really small nitty gritty detailing that requires you to work with art and engineering and audio and all of these things to bring together to make something actually afforded in a way that the player can discover.
So. Mm. Yeah. The thing that comes to mind is that VR is like being in a waking dream, that there's a part of the dream logic that we're communicating in a way that dreams communicate with us, with these kind of signs and symbols and meanings, and that the way that we are able to kind of already walk through the world and understand what we can do in it. But this type of semiotic process is being translated into spatial design in a way. So
I love that you said that, because when we were working on Starship Home early on, we started talking about the design of Starship Home as the design of a shared daydream. It's like, we're not trying to make a game. We're trying to imagine a dream. And there are actually several dreams that take place in the context of the game as well, but basically trying to give people just enough props and just enough things that they can interact with that they're able to enter into that state of unreality where you can actually get enough of a sense that the world is real and that it's working as you expect it to do. And our cheat for that was that we just didn't have a ton of objects in the game, but every object was incredibly interactive and had lots of different ways that you could touch it and poke it and pull it and stretch it. And that for us is like, right, the immersion lives in that level of detailing that oftentimes you just don't have the time to do that for like 100 objects, but you can maybe do it for 20.
Yeah. So yeah, for sure. All right. Well, we've got two more chapters. The chapter 8 is the spatial computing in the brain, where you really start to dive into the neuroscience part of what the neuroscientists saying in terms of perception and our body, and trying to give a broader neuroscientific perspective of what's happening with the spatial computing in the brain.
Yeah, so in this chapter, it's a bit of a funky chapter. I feel when I was discussing with Doug, I was like, I want to talk about bias and I want to talk about neuroscience. Can I bring those two things together? Why not? It's our book. So that's what this chapter is about. It is a bit about neuroscience, and it's also talking about bias and different types of bias, because when you are working on an experience, you need to think about what you're bringing to the table, right? Who are you? What bias are you bringing? And how is that being integrated into what you're designing and making? And so my hope with writing this chapter is that people would have an understanding of what their bias are. And then from the neuroscience perspective, having an understanding of how these different nerves work in our body with the experiences that we are doing. And I had a lot of fun. I'm a nerd, and I had a lot of fun researching this information, because there were things that I didn't know that I got to put in this book about, you know, the different nerves that I thought were key, right? Looking at our eyes, looking at the vagus nerve, right? So I think having an idea of how our bodies are impacted by these experiences is something that creators should know and think about, is alongside what they're bringing to the table when they're creating something. So that's how the chapter came to life.
Yeah, so you have like the anchoring bias, attribution bias, availability bias, halo effect, outgroup bias, overconfidence bias, representativeness bias, selection bias, and then self-serving bias, social desirability bias, status quo bias, and stereotyping bias. Where did you come up with the list of all these biases, and just maybe can elaborate on that?
Yeah. So, I mean, when you look, there's a whole humongous chart of different biases that exist. Right. And so I thought, which biases relate most to XR and the experiences themselves? So that's how I came up with the list, is like, if anyone ever wants to look up this chart of biases, it's quite huge. But which ones relate specifically to AR and VR and immersive experiences? Those were the ones, and I think I stuck to 10-ish, are the ones that I thought were most related to like immersive and human spatial computing experiences.
And so is there a general strategy for all of them, or is it just context dependent for each one as you're designing something, trying to imagine how these biases might be coming into play? Or what's the general strategy for overcoming bias?
I wouldn't say like you can't look at all of them at once. I think you could take one and examine it, right? You can take one and look and say, okay, what, you know, who am I? What am I bringing to this experience? So this is, you know, when I think about myself, right? I have a certain perspective. I'm a woman. I'm a Black woman. I'm from the United States, right? These are the perspectives that I bring to the table. So when I go and create something, it's from my perspective, right? A lot of times. So when you are looking at this list of biases, you know, some may spark something in you, some may not. And if one does spark something in you, then how can you carry that over and go, well, what exactly am I doing for this experience, right? Am I seeing this only from my male perspective? Like, what if a woman decides, or someone who's non-binary decides to use this experience? Are we making it so that it's fair and equitable for them? Now, this may not even come into some people's minds. Some people don't care. Okay. And if you don't, that's your prerogative. That's up to you. But if you are wanting to make an experience where you can have the most people using it, which is the idea for me behind one of the guiding forces behind having an understanding of your bias, having an understanding of how things work. If you are creating a game, if you are creating an immersive experience, don't you want the most people to use it?
Yeah.
Are you wanting to leave people out of it? And if you are wanting to leave people out of it, then you're not going to examine your biases. You're just going to go and do what you want to do. But if you actually want something and you want more engagement with it, then you need to have, for one, I think, a good understanding of where you come from. And then on top of that, being more open to making things where more people can use it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing that comes to mind is that, you know, having diverse teams is like the first line of attack against these, because then you're able to perhaps surface issues before they get to the stage of when you're trying to test it. And by that time, it may already be way too late to overcome some of these dimensions, but that user testing can also be a way of surfacing some of these, and that there could be iterative cycles that you still have capacity. But yeah, having diverse teams and also just, yeah, you have your own situated knowledge of your perspective, but you can't empathize with everybody at the same time. And so having people give you that feedback that you may be not seeing, I think, is a process of trying to, in order to make it something that works for everyone, you need to have as many people as possible see it and then give you directly that feedback and see if you can somehow integrate it.
Yeah. And in the process of this book, I also created a set of cards, like a human spatial computing alphabet.
Oh, wow.
Plug.
Oh, nice.
And yeah. And ode to Doug, there's an embodiment design card. So it gives a little definition and two questions. And it's a whole set A through Z.
Oh, cool.
And so when I was thinking about, you know, what could a team actually use, they could use this. And they can pull a card and go, well, am I thinking about, you know, flexible user interfaces? Right. And giving a definition and then asking two questions. And, you know, one of the things that Doug and I were big on is like having questions at the end of every chapter of this book so that we're not just talking at you. This is a way for you to be engaged and interact, right? When we have these questions, this is for you, for your context, for your specific situation. Because we don't have all the answers. We just did some reading. We did some researching. We did some writing. We did some collaborating. And then now it's yours.
Mm. Beautiful. Very cool. Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, like I would say, like, this book is wrong. Like, we are wrong. But I think in that, and I think so much of Reg and I's conversations around writing this book were about our own biases and about our own limitations in understanding the complexity of a lot of these topics. And I think the big hope there is that people go through this and what they come out with is a lot of questions, because we both left this project with a lot of questions. But also something that we discussed about bias that I think was an interesting conversation we had multiple times was that sometimes it's fine. And sometimes, like, it's okay actually to make something that isn't for everyone. But in doing that, you should understand that that's what you're doing. And then you should go really hard at that. I think like a great example that we talked about a couple of times is like horror games. Is like, horror games are not for everyone. And that doesn't mean that you should make them less scary to make them appealing to everyone, because then it's not a horror game anymore. It's not scary. It like loses the audience that it's for, right? And there are things like that where it's like, you should know who the audience is. You should know exactly that that's what you're doing. And don't try to let anybody else in if that's not the goal, right? Like, but you have to be able to actually do the definitional work and the audience work to really understand, like, who is it actually for? Do we actually know that that's what we're doing? And then, like, are we going to go super hard after that? And oftentimes, I think what that opens up is like, actually, maybe we could let a few more people in. Like, maybe there's an option to let more people in than we originally expected. And that's, I think, usually the work that ends up here is like, you're never going to get to everyone, but you could probably get wider than you expect. And I think that's where, like, this chapter of like, the only way you're going to get there is by digging in and actually being able to define, like, this is the bias that we have, and this is why we've been thinking that. And to your point, Kent, is like, the easiest way to do that is like, you should hire a couple of people who are not into the thing that you're doing and who can just be there every day to be like, I still don't like the thing that we're doing. Because that voice of dissent and that voice of opposition is often, I think, where you find that magical middle ground of something that is more broadly appealing and accessible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. I wouldn't say your book is wrong. Everything is going to be inherently incomplete, and so you can have more completeness. So there's a part of a pluralism where you're trying to get as many perspectives as you can. But yeah, I guess as we go into this last chapter, I ask all my interviewees about the ultimate potential. I feel like this is, in some sense, the ultimate potential chapter, where you're talking about both the potentials of where we could go in the future, but also kind of an odds and ends of other things that maybe didn't fit in other chapters. That's kind of like a synthesis of all these other things. So maybe love to hear you just talk about your final thoughts of the where we go from here and what you wanted to include in this final chapter as we start to wrap up here.
Yeah, I mean, when we were thinking about what the last chapter should be, I think I was like, oh, the future. And I was like, we don't know what the future is. We don't. We have no idea. But we could talk about what we would like it to be, right? We could talk about where we are, what has happened, and what could be. And, you know, that's to Doug's point, like, who do we want to be? What do we want to create? And this is often not asked when we're working on a project and we're so deep in it. We're not thinking about the outcomes of that. We're not thinking about the risks that are associated with that. And no matter how good your intentions are, there's a risk for everything, right? When these technologies came, when Facebook came out, no one had any idea what beautiful things could come out of it and what harm could come out of it as well, right? So with this stuff that we're working on, you know, we have to look at it holistically. We can't just look at it, oh, this fun game came out. Well, this fun game is teaching people how to do really bad things, right? So I think a holistic view is what we try to apply to this last chapter.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that's what we try to do really throughout the book. And I would say, like, you know, my hope is that this is like a starting point for a lot of people, right? Like, a single chapter on embodiment is like the door into thousands and thousands of books and articles and essays and research studies, right? But I think the thing that has stuck with me is that some of the conversations that Regine and I were having a few years ago about AI and about the overlap between these technologies, because in part, we were very much not trying to write a book about AI, but while we were starting to write this book, that was becoming such a deep part of the conversation. We were seeing a lot of the companies that were investing in XR start to pivot the majority of their investment in R&D towards AI. And that, again, from my view, and, you know, we write about this in the last chapter, which, like, we really didn't change almost anything in the last chapter from about 3 years ago when we wrote that chapter. But to me, like, it's more like poignant now than it was then, which is that, from my view, like, AI is the killer app for XR, but in so many ways, like, it is also the killing app. Like, it is the thing that makes these devices so dangerous, but also is more than likely the real thing that will, like, increase adoption. And, like, that is not why this technology has ever been interesting to me. I'm interested in, like, the deep human personal magic that is possible with this technology, that I can have a wild idea and then I can invite you inside of that idea in a way that goes beyond what is capable with any other technology, but in a lot of ways is so similar to what we have been doing with storytelling and our imaginations. Like, XR is like, it's an imagination aid, and adults benefit greatly from imagination aids. And that's where I actually think that, like, I don't think XR should really be used by young people very much, because they don't need an imagination aid. They have it already. And then that's why they connect so viscerally to it, because it's like imagination steroids. And so if you already have a wild imagination, then, oh man, is it exciting to have, like, an imagination augmenting machine. But that's really what I hope for from this technology, is that I hope that it is an invitation to people to be more imaginative, and that in an ideal scenario, it's what gets us away from smartphones and from computers, because, like, humans are not going to stop interfacing with computers anytime in the near future. But wouldn't it be great if we did that in a more embodied and active way, instead of in an isolated and sedentary way? And I think that's the, like, positive view that I see. And it, right, it comes with a lot of dangers and pitfalls, but we're already living through most of those with our smartphones. And I don't think anyone thinks that leaving smartphones behind would be bad for us. It just really is a matter of who we become when we embrace something new. What's the next technology that will really define us and our relationships with each other. And I think the answer right now is like, that's going to be very complicated, especially when you think about AI in the mix there. Yeah, but that's like a whole nother book. So. Mm.
Yeah. Well, Doug and Rajne, thanks so much for joining me here on the podcast. And Doug, like you said, I feel like this book is a great pointer to all of these different design disciplines that within each of them, they're proper design disciplines within themselves. So it's impossible to cover everything in one book, but I feel like you did a really great job of tying in the key parts of this intersection of XR and what do human spatial computer designers, human computer interaction designers, XR designers, immersive storytellers, immersive artists, what do they need to know in terms of the design disciplines that are being pulled together and everything from embodiment and human-computer interaction and neuroscience, and you have affordances and architecture and game design, all these different things that are all being fused together. And then also ethics, universal design and accessibility, all these other issues that aren't always included at the forefront. So I really feel like this book is building from the foundation of human rights and trying to put that as a solid foundation. And I can really see that throughout the entirety of this book, how these themes come back to trying to empathize with these other perspectives and trying to make something work for as many people as you can. So thanks again for joining me here today on the podcast to break down your
book.
Thank
you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kent. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, this has been so fun. Thank you, Kent, for this opportunity for us to share about our book.
So that was Rajne Gilbert and Doug Northcook, and they have a brand new book that came out on February 5th, 2026 called Human Spatial Computing. So I have a number of different takeaways about this interview is that, first of all, well, this is a really rich book that I think is covering lots of different aspects of XR. And I think we give a really great overview of that in the context of this conversation. You can kind of hear them going back and forth where they're really taking responsibility for each of these different chapters and starting off on ethics and human rights and universal design. Also, just all the different disciplines and their unique insights that are also fused together throughout the course of this. And because XR and spatial computing is really fusing all these different things together. And so what's so fascinating about XR and spatial computing is that it's really truly interdisciplinary. And so you kind of have to know a little bit around all these different things that are happening. And so this is very similar to the training that an architect would go through to be able to understand all these different things of what's it mean to design for the human body and taking into account the semiotic transmission of meaning for psychology and architecture and how do you design for that and getting feedback from folks. And so, yeah, it's basically all the different factors you need to consider when creating spatial computing experiences. And also based upon human rights. And so starting off with that, but also continually coming back to looking through the lens of accessibility and inclusion and all the different ethical dilemmas that are coming up in the context of XR. So yeah, it's a very rich book. I think it's probably one of the most robust textbooks that I've seen in terms of covering different aspects of human spatial computing. And so definitely check it out because I think it's a really comprehensive overview of so much of what's happening within the context of XR. And yeah, hopefully I was able to give a little bit of a flavor for a lot of the big points that I found really fascinating throughout the course of reading this book. So that's all I have for today. And I just want to thank you for listening to the Voices of VR podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, then please do spread the word, tell your friends, and consider becoming a member of the Patreon. This is a listener-supported podcast, and so I do rely upon donations from people like yourself in order to continue bringing this coverage. So you can become a member and donate today at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.